I, like Brother David, are going to start with the QR code. After Brother Bill's appeal for folks to sign up for the Advocate, I thought I would make it really easy for everybody, because I'm sure everybody's got their phone with them in here. This should take you straight to the Advocate subscription page. If you just follow that link, I'll put in a plug for the Advocate. Follow the link, forward the link to your family members as well. But that'll take you straight to subscriptions. And if you have any questions beyond that, that stops my involvement in the process. I would go find Whitney or James or Bill. All right. So, I don't know. I like to start, since we're talking about Jerusalem, I like to start with pictures. For those of you who don't know, this is the Damascus Gate. There was a gate at Jesus' time to the north called the Damascus Gate. Of course, it did not look like this. If you're interested, this empties to the north of the city into what's historically been a little bit more of a Palestinian area, but it leads you off into the garden with the temple, or the tomb of the garden of the tomb. Put you into that area. All right. So continuing where we are. Go ahead and get back to Matthew chapter 24, please. And yesterday, we attempted to answer the first question of the apostles, when shall these things be? Or how long until the temple is destroyed? And the answer that I tried to guide you down the garden path to get to was that if the answer is when you see armies around Jerusalem, is you know when this temple is going to be destroyed. The second question, if you remember what the apostles asked, was what will be the sign of thy coming? And so we'll pick up there today. And the apostles used the word, Greek word, Simeon, or sign, in their question. And in this section of Matthew 24, this is the first time Jesus is going to use that same word in his response. So I think it kind of serves as an indicator that he is providing an answer to the question about a sign or token of his coming and the ending of the age. Luke uses that term earlier in his discourse, but it's before any, but he uses it to say that before any sign occurs, the apostle and the faithful will go through all these different tribulations. So he's still using it consistently. Now, like the previous question, we first have a warning, an exhortation not to be deceived. False messiahs and false prophets may create signs, or what we would possibly interpret as signs, but we are supposed to ignore them. The sign that we are specifically to look for is laid out as the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. So let's go through verses 29 through 30 here, one at a time. And I'm graying out the ones on the slide that we're not talking about, just to help everybody kind of focus what we're looking at. So in 29, we have this. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of heaven shall be shaken. So first, Jesus tells us the sign will be after the destruction of Jerusalem, after that tribulation of that time. That's pretty clear. It's after the destruction. The period of the gap until the sign is actually revealed is the time of the Gentiles that we get from Luke. We also understand that the sun, the moon, the stars, the power of the heavens are metaphorical for powers, systems, institutions of this world. And again, at this point, our Lord is heavily invoking the language of the prophets. In particular, he's leaning on Isaiah and Joel, all of which definitely puts this context, as opposed to the destruction of AD 70, as in the day of the Lord, right? So we're moving forward here in time. Next, in verse 30, we have the sign. And I'm focused on Matthew because, it's again, Matthew uses that word sign both in the question and the answer. Matthew records, then shall the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the man coming in clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Now again, I harped on this a lot yesterday, but I'll bring this up again. I don't know if your Bible puts in some sort of section or chapter headings, but the New American Standard Bible or the Blue Letter Bible use the heading, quote unquote, the glorious return for this section of verses. Your Bible might have something similar. Yes, this section has to do with Christ's return, but the question, the apostles who ask this question about the sign aren't thinking about a return, right? They're not asking, when are you coming back, right? They didn't know he was going to leave. They weren't accepting that, right? It's not about, when are you coming back? Their question is still always, what will be your arrival as king? Yes, the return, Christ's return to earth from heaven is concurrent with that answer, but that's not what they're asking. They're not asking when you will return. They're asking when you will be arriving as king. So again, we have to just be careful. Try not to mix up our knowledge and expectations with what they had. So I'm going to parse this verse a little bit, but I'm going to do it in reverse order. And I have a good reason for doing this, because I want to kind of step us through here to kind of get into this context. The last phrase of verse 30 states, "And they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." And this, in fact, is the only answer that is recorded by Mark and Luke. So that's one of the reasons we're going to start here. So, one of the questions is, when is your parousia? When are you going to arrive as king? The answer is, when he comes in the clouds of heaven with power and glory. We understand clouds to be representative of a group of immortalized beings, right? A heavenly host. A synonymous word, at least according to Thayer's for clouds, is used by Paul in Hebrews 12:1 in the sense of a large, dense multitude, a throng, a cloud of witnesses. When he writes, "We are also compassed with such a great cloud of witnesses." The next portion of it is, who is they that shall see the Son of Man coming in clouds? That is answered by Matthew when he says, "Then all the tribes of the earth shall mourn." Now, all of us have preferences. I have and biases. I'm not a giant fan of the NIV. But in this case, I think it has a translation that is particularly clear and helpful. It says, "And then all the peoples of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man coming in clouds of heaven with power and great glory." For the King James Version, and then, the NIV substitutes the word when to connect these two clauses. And as far as I can tell, that is a acceptable translation of that Greek word. So the whole earth sees the Son of Man coming with the multitude and glory, and they mourn because of it. Right? They mourn when they see this. So I think that helps us with some of the order and tells us what events are part of this verse. The time when the tribes of the earth see the Son of Man coming with a multitude and in power, their reaction is to mourn. When Christ and the saints come to deliver Jerusalem, that is when they start to mourn. The saints are this cloud. Zechariah 12 tells us, "And it shall come to pass in that day I will seek to destroy all nations that come against Jerusalem." That definitely will make the nations mourn when they see this deliverance. In addition, I think this is paralleled in John's opening of Revelation. In Revelation 1:7, he says, "Behold, he cometh with clouds, and every eye shall see him, and they also which pierced him, and all the kindred of the earth shall wail because of him." Right? We have nations wail because they know destruction is coming. The next point in the section about the earth mourning when they see the Son of Man coming is introduced by this clause, "and then." According to Strong's, the word "then" is used for things that occur in sequence. Thayer's notes that it is introducing something in the future relevant to the previous clause. Therefore, this is why I'm going backwards, the mourning of the tribes of the earth, the mourning of the tribes of the earth, in response to seeing this multitude of saints, happens after the phrase preceding it. That phrase is, and then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. So, here is the sign that is in response to the apostles' question. Note that it is introduced by that phrase, and then. So it's an event that happens after the tribulation. And those days mentioned in verse 25, or 29. But it's before Christ's revelation to the world. So what is the sign of the man? So what is the sign of the Son of Man in heaven? Well, Mansfield in his story of the Bible opts for a very general interpretation. Right, drawing on the metaphorical use of the verse of heavens in verse 29, he argues that verse 30 is Christ coming as king, and the end of the age is when he's in a place of power. Right, the sign of Christ being in power is when he's in power. That feels kind of circular to me in its logic, but he might be right. Okay. There are others who believe this means Christ will be visible for the sky for all the world to see. I'm sure some of you have seen this. This appears in things like Harry Whitaker's commentary. That feels very unlikely to me. That's out of order, right, from this verse. You know, we know things like, from this verse and other passages, from Isaiah's question of who is this cometh from Edom, and from the passages in Zechariah, it is clear the Jewish people in the world do not know who has delivered them. And Jerusalem, right? Like it is something they do not, it's an uncertainty and unknown. So any revelation of a being in the sky would seem to kind of make the latter announcement about who this is to deliver you kind of redundant or kind of less than surprising, right? And a little illogical. In the Gospel of Mark commentary, Alfred Norris thinks the sign is referenced back to Zechariah 12:2. It says, they shall look upon whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him. He thinks that connects quite well with the mourning of all tribes of the earth in the balance of the verse. Again, that's true, and that's going to happen. But it doesn't explain the in heaven aspect part of this sign that Jesus replies with. Also right here in Matthew, it says the tribes of the earth mourn when they see him coming with power and glory, not when they see the sign. So that doesn't sound that great either. So, now that I've given you a bunch of false alternatives, like this is a standard rhetorical device, right? I've given you a bunch of false alternatives and knocked them all down to set up what clearly is the right one, right? But that's not true. I'm not saying it's clearly right, but it just... We got to find something. So, what event happens before Christ marches to save Jerusalem? Well, frankly, the only thing I can think of, it's his return to the earth and judgment. Right? So if I could make the suggestion, I think what the sign Jesus is talking about is going to be the fulfillment of Acts 1:11. This is when the angel standing by the apostles said, ye men of Galilee, why stand ye gazing up into heaven? This same Jesus which is taken up from you into heaven shall come again in like manner as you have seen him go into heaven. Christ will literally return from heaven. This is not the presentation to the world. This is a sign for the household, right? This is a signal. This is a token. This is our understanding of when an event is going to happen. The apostles ask, what is your sign you will be arriving as king? That's what they asked. They were looking for something now. They were looking for a sign immediately. His answer is, in effect, when you see my return. He doesn't phrase it as a return, but I think that's what they would ultimately come to understand. So within this verse, you will see his return, which will indicate his return from heaven, will indicate he is there to be king. That will end the current age. That will return, and his return will start the messianic age, and the world will be subject to judgment to him and the saints. That's just my suggestion. That's just my suggestion. But whatever it is, we have to harmonize it with the verse, for sure. You might like the other expositors better. And to be honest, I wouldn't blame you. So, let's look at the next verse. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, one from one end of heaven to the other, from the uttermost parts of the earth to the uttermost parts of heaven. I will admit straight up, I always thought about this as the gathering of us to judgment. You can actually look at my Bible. That's where all my cross references go. This verse sounded just like 1 Thessalonians in my mind. However, we have a little problem. If verse 30 operates just as I laid it out, we go Christ and the saints, manifestation to the world, his march against the nations. This puts the call to judgment out of order. If we go previously to say that that is his march against the nations, this is out of order. Now, again, Alfred Norris's commentary on Mark believes that this is the resurrection and the call of the saints to judgment, right? This, I think, is probably the most common view for folks. However, for it to work, you have to be willing to do one of two things. One, you have to be willing to read verse 31 as not following in chronological order. Alternatively, you have to read verse 30 and 31 about the judgment and gathering of the saints only and omit any judgment on the Gentile nations. For those two verses to work, you've got to choose one of those two alternatives if you want to adopt that. This is the call to judgment. And I'll admit, either one of those is a little hard for me to swallow. To me, so far, Christ's response has been very linear and very chronological. Right? He's stepping through time in very linear fashion. All of a sudden, for us to stop and break that pattern and assume, okay, everything's been linear up until this exact point, and then ignore that, I think doesn't fit with the flow. If we were to follow what he's saying, we should continue to be linear. Probably more importantly, if we look at verse 30, it says, the nations mourn. To me, that sounds like it's judgment on the nations. I am pretty sure I am going to be very fearful when Christ returns, right? This is going to shaky knees, scary thing, fearful. But I am definitely not going to be mourning that arrival. I don't think anybody in the household is going to mourn his arrival, right? So I don't think it fits. That portion of the verse fits in that context either. So I don't particularly care for that argument. Mansfield book argues that this is the restoration of the Jews to Israel. That would fit chronologically. That would fit thematically. As in, so far, the prophecy has largely focused on what will befall the nation of Israel. Talking to his Jewish disciples, is delivered in response to a question about the restoration of the kingdom of Israel, for which the apostles of this time would have been very, for lack of a better term, Israel-centric, right? I think they understood that all nations of the earth shall be blessed, right? House of prayer for all people, but bringing in the Gentiles and having Gentiles and all that stuff right at the beginning wasn't something they had a great concept on. And we see that how well that plays out in Acts and things like Galatians. So it fits kind of thematically there. Also, Mark adds this phrase, to his response, I'm doing this because it's on my screen over here, from the uttermost parts of the earth. And according to Thayer's commentary or lexicon, the ancients conceived of the expanded sky as an arch or vault over the entire world, from the outermost edge touching the extreme limits of the earth to going to the other limits of the earth. And so it pretty much means across the world is what that phrase means. And this phrase is actually very close to Nehemiah's prayer about the scattered nation. Just look at Nehemiah real quick. Nehemiah 1, verses 8 and 9. Nehemiah 1, 8 to 9. Remember, I beseech thee, the word which thou commanded thy servant Moses, saying, if ye will transgress, I will scatter you abroad among the nations. But if ye turn unto me and keep my commandments and do them, though there were of you cast out unto the uttermost parts of the heaven, yet I will gather them from thence and bring them unto the place that I have chosen to set my name there. That's very similar language specific to Israel. Now, the word elect, that's another problem. That word elect can definitely be applied to us. And undoubtedly, those of us who have put on the saving name of Christ are elect. We are the elect. That's fine. But elect can also be applied to the nation of Israel only. The word electos is the word the Septuagint uses specifically for Isaiah 45, verse 4. For Jacob my servant's sake, and Israel mine elect, I have called thee by thy name, I have summoned thee, though thou hast not known me. Likewise in Isaiah 43, 20, it says God refers to Israel as his chosen. That word is elect in the Greek. It's using the same word. In the New Testament, generally, elect is used broadly to encompass the entire household, which I will freely admit is a challenge to this argument. But I don't think it totally undermines the point that it could be used narrowly. So, where does that leave us? So after hearing the temple would be destroyed, the apostles came and asked, when shall these things be? And the answer he gives them is when the Roman armies, we know them to be the Romans, besiege Jerusalem, and what will be the sign of thy coming in the end of the world? The answer, when the Son of Man returns from the right hand of power at his heavenly Father's side. So, I could do one of two things. I can elicit comments now, or I can be fearful that everybody is hyped up on caffeine and sugar after the break. And I don't want to do that. Get people talking. So what I'm going to do is we're going to progress forward with our next section. We're going to leave the Olivet Prophecy behind. If you want to talk to me afterwards, I'm more than happy to. Or if we have some time at the end of the day, we'll come back to it. Again, like Brother David, I've got my slides up here. I will echo his request. This is a exercise of trust that you're not going to read all ahead and spoil my surprises or come complaining to me before I've even got a chance to say anything. So I will still have some printout versions in the future for people who still like paper. I'm giving you these now because we're back into the land of maps and images, which might make some things easier for folks to get through. So here we go. Again, for those of you who don't know, this is the Golden Gate, which is on the east side of Jerusalem. It's probably the most famous gate. It's probably one of the more famous gates. It's once considered to be one of the more beautiful gates in Jerusalem. It faces the Mount of Olives. It was walled up, 14th, 15th century, somewhere around there. All right. So, we're going to take, this is our theme verse for our next section as we move on. This is from Psalm 83. It says, they have said, come, let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. So what I'm going to cover today, hopefully, or today and a bit of tomorrow, is some post-biblical history, some modern Israel, and the best we can hold on to current events as we can. And we're going to hopefully use this to set the stage for what will be the last part of class, where we talk about all the people of the earth gathered together against Jerusalem. So if we consider kind of putting the Olivet prophecy aside, that makes us come up to AD 70, right? The temple has been destroyed, and we're going to move forward. This is not going to be a super deep dive into history, because you can see just from this rough outline, there's going to be a lot of stuff that happens in effectively 2,000 years, which, you know, 2,000 years is a long time, so you would expect a lot of stuff to happen. We'll just get a flavor of some of the more famous events and a feel for how much the world has struggled for control over Jerusalem during all of this time. Again, here's the Damascus Gate. It's kind of a neat place. All right. So, the single most important event in the 100 years after the destruction of AD 70 is what is termed the Bar Kokhba Revolution, or the Second Jewish Revolt. This was during the reign of the Emperor Hadrian. For those of you who know your history, Hadrian's the one who built the big wall across the top of England. So he decides that the remaining Jewish populace in Jerusalem needs to be Hellenized, or converted to be like all of the Gentile Hellen Romans, Greek Romans. So, since AD 70, Jews had been returning to the area in the past few decades, and according to Jewish historians, they were even working up ideas on rebuilding the temple. So Hadrian tries to force integration by doing the following things. He bans circumcision. He turns the city, which had largely just been a fort, into a colony of Rome. And he puts a statue of Jupiter on the Temple Mount. Of course, this is the sort of thing that leads to rebellion, which it does. And the leader of rebellion was a man named Simeon Bar Kokhba, or Bar Kosaba. Bar in Hebrew means son of, and Kosaba is either the name of the city he was from or just the name of his father. A very famous Jewish rabbi is alive at the time. He's the leading rabbi. He is named Rabbi Akiva. If you have ever heard of him, he renames Simon Bar Kokhba, or starts calling him Simon Bar Kokhba, or son of the star, which is a reference to Balaam's prophecy of Numbers 24:17. And there shall come a star out of Jacob, and the scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite the corners of Moab, and destroy the children of Seth. So obviously, Rabbi Akiva is proclaiming Simon Bar Kokhba as messianic, and likely Bar Kokhba is going to fall into this category of false messiahs that Christ was warning about in the Olivet Prophecy. He leads the army, and he's actually, it turns out, to be a pretty effective leader. He's successful enough that he starts calling himself the prince, and even starts minting his own coins, some of which you can see up there, if you see on the right. And one on top, you can clearly see an image of the temple. He holds off the Romans for about 3 years. The rebellion is strong enough that Hadrian has to come to Judea himself to put this down, and he comes with the nation's leading general. Eventually, Bar Kokhba is killed. This introduces what is called the Age of Persecution by the Jews. The war was terrible, as all wars with the Romans were. According to Josephus, 580,000 were killed in battle, and the Romans may have destroyed as many as 1,000 villages in Judea. The following were forbidden after this rebellion. By law, by Roman law. You could not study the law. You could not observe the Sabbath. You could not observe circumcision. You could not have a mezuzah. And Jews were prohibited by law from walking even near Jerusalem. It's not enough that you can't come in. You can't even get near the city. You're out. The Temple Mount was plowed over, and Jerusalem becomes a pagan city. So, massive destruction yet again. Now we come to the Byzantine period. Up until this point, every Roman emperor had been pagan. And that changes with Constantine the Great in 324 AD. The Roman Empire becomes nominally Christian, and he moves the capital from Rome to Byzantium or Constantinople. Sorry, I can't think of that without thinking of the song. So, this change increases the influence of apostate Christianity a lot, as you would expect. Also really important is Constantine's mother to the city of Jerusalem. Her name is Helen. She travels to Jerusalem and found churches on the place that she decides are the Holy Sepulchre, the place of the Nativity, and the place of the Ascension. On her travel, she also manages to find the true cross, several nails, Jesus' tunic, the site of the burning bush in Sinai, and other relics. That's a pretty big hit list, and one of my books sarcastically referred to her as probably the greatest archaeologist of all time. If you know anything about the Dark Ages in medieval history, the populace goes crazy for this sort of thing, right? And this is really the time when Jerusalem starts as a pilgrim destination, or even better, it becomes a touristy place. This is when it becomes a tourist destination for across Europe. Now, in 476, Rome falls and only the eastern leg of the empire remains. So moving along, we're going to move along in history. We're going to skip forward to 634. This is when Muhammad dies. And a really interesting feature of Islam and the rise of Muhammad is he creates this empire and this movement, but he never instituted any succession planning. He never bothered to do that. So after his death, leadership moves between the members of his family and the tribes that took him in during his flight and his travels. And this is known as the patriarchal caliphate. Caliphate comes from the word kafala, which means successor. So all of these leaders are from Mecca. And the second caliphate was a man named Omar. He conquered Jerusalem in 638 or 637, depending on which sources you read. And in 685, the Dome of the Rock was started, and it was finished in 691. So the dome is sometimes called the Mosque of Omar. But it isn't a mosque, it's a shrine, and Omar didn't have it constructed. So in good kind of ironic fun, it's neither a mosque nor Omar. But that's what we see as the most relevant impact of that conquest. And after the fourth caliphate, Islam starts to split. And by the end of the millennium, Jerusalem is in the control of the Egyptian Fatimid caliphate. So, of course, there's a lot of history over the next four centuries, but we're only going to fast forward through the first millennium. In 1009, the Caliphate al-Hakmin bi Ammar, who by all accounts was a super mentally unstable ruler from Egypt, he decides to destroy the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. He thinks it needs to go. And so up until this point, the Muslims had actually been reasonably tolerant, as far as Dark Age governments go, of Jews and different religions. However, with this threatening of the Holy Sepulchre, and along with the caliphate's increasing movement north and encroaching upon Byzantium, this gets the attention of the Western Roman powers that are left. So, in case you're keeping score, up until this point, we've had Romans, Byzantians, Saudi Arabians, Syrians, and Egyptians all claiming some governance or rulership or ownership of Jerusalem. And now we're going to start adding kings of Europe. I'm going to kind of skip through the Crusades, but the Crusades do take Jerusalem. When the Crusaders take Jerusalem, they enact laws against the Jews. They manage to take Jerusalem. They manage to lose Jerusalem and other cities off and on for a couple of hundred years. If you remember your high school history at all, the Crusades were kind of a combination of religious fanaticism, pilgrim expeditions, and a really easy way to get rid of extra European noblemen that you didn't need. After the Crusades, the city is taken by Saladin, who is the Sultan of Egypt. He's actually Kurdish, however, but he's the Sultan of Egypt. He is best remembered in history as the opponent of Richard the Lionheart in the Crusades. They were opponents at the height of chivalry and have an interesting interplay between their battles. This is Richard the Lionheart here. This is in front of the Parliament Building in London. He looks a little different than the Disney cartoon I grew up with, but that's still him. Following him are various different Muslim dynasties. So despite all of like the romanticism and importance attached to Richard the Lionheart, he does not conquer Jerusalem again. It stays in Muslim hands from here on out, from him forward. Following him are variously different Muslim dynasties, and we're not going to go or care too much all about them now. All we need to know is that they were of varying tolerance to the Jews. In 1250, for example, the Mamluk dynasty actually destroys the walls of Jerusalem. And by that time, contemporary accounts suggest that there were maybe only 200 Jews living in the city in the 1200s. I believe we're all familiar with the Ottoman Empire. We associate it with the ending, with its ending with Revelation 16:12, right? And the sixth angel poured out its vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the waters of there was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. Before it falls in 1917, it conquered and held Jerusalem for 400 years. The walls around Jerusalem today were built by the Ottoman Emperor Suleiman the Magnificent, which Suleiman is just going to be the Arabic version of Solomon. So, by this time, so when we end at this time, all the way up to 1917, we can now add French, England, and modern Turkey all laying some kind of claim to Jerusalem. We can also throw in Russia and Germany. When Constantinople falls, which used to be Byzantium, which used to be, which became Byzantium, which became Istanbul, when it falls, Russia lays claim to be the third Rome and assumes a lot of the political protection of the Christian sects in Jerusalem. The Roman czars are very active in saying they are the protectors of those churches. Because of its closeness to Europe, the European powers frequently court alliances with the Ottoman Empire, and this includes the famous visit of Kaiser of Germany riding on Jerusalem in a white horse. We're going to put it up here. This is the Kaiser way in the back there, but he rides into Jerusalem on a white horse. We put this picture up here because it sets up a famous contrast with the power that's going to come next to occupy Jerusalem. In addition, it is interesting to note that in World War II, German troops were stationed in Jerusalem. I'm sorry, in World War I, German troops were stationed in Jerusalem fighting against the British and advances along with the Ottomans as their allies. We're going to stop here because we're going to move into a brand new section of history next time. And I guess I will take a second to invite any questions or comments that folks might want to throw.
I think we got
about, we have?
What?
10 minutes? 1 minute?
No.
Do I have 1 minute or 10? I got 10 minutes. Oh boy, okay. 10 minutes. Oh, 10.
So, your breakdown of Matthew 24, you don't have to read your act, you've got to just do it. No, I agree with how you kind of broken down, like the first, basically 28 verses referring to the subjects of 80, 70, and you're getting into 30 and 31, you basically, is it strictly chronological or not? And I think, if you look at, verse 24, it talks about these false Christs rising up. That obviously happened right before AD 70. But then I think they put basically verses 25 through 28. You can almost put those in parentheses because Christ is referring to his actual coming. He's kind of like, instead of saying, hey, these are the next things that are going to happen, he's talking about his coming episode and contrasting with the coming of these false prophets. Basically, all these people are going to come up, they're going to be so deceitful that they can deceive even the very elect. They go on to explain, well, this is what my coming is going to be like. And then in verse 29, he kind of jumps back into the tribulation after the 80 70 days. So basically, I see that as kind of a sort of a side note where it's not supposed to be strictly chronological, but hey, while I'm on the subject, I'll comment on this and then I'll get back to chronology. So I wonder if that has any impact on 30 and 31. If 31 could be sort of a side note of his coming, of where it could potentially still refer to the gathering of the saints, but it doesn't say then he shall send him the angels, or at least in this account. But if any of that.
No, I'm totally following you, and that's one of the requirements that you have to do, right? Like, if you want, if you have to be willing to read it not following as linear as I have structured it. However, I would say that even if you kind of have that aside view as you have, which I think is a reasonable interpretation, you still have to address what looks to be very chronological and linear within within verse 30, right? Like verse 30 feels like it is laid out in a very linear way, and you have to account for that. Your view still has to account for that linear layout. Would be my challenge I'm having with it, Mac.
Well, in support of what you said, Brother Josh, because I think you were right. Some of my Bible notes that I put concerning the elect there is a reference to Romans 11. Remember what Paul says that their enemies concerning the gospel setting of the Jewish people, but concerning the election, he calls them the election. In 2 Timothy 2:10, Paul also refers to his Jewish brethren there by the term of elect. So I can use those verses to help support your
point. Yeah, I agree. And it's a good point, right? Like, we normally think of the elect being a broader term. We are having to be willing to read it as a narrower term. But I think if we're willing to do that, we are standing on some firm ground that is, Brother Max said, it's kind of in other verses like that.
Brother Mark. I think it's important to keep in mind, as you mentioned, that he's referring to these individuals with the conception of what they have of what is going to be unfolding and how he would deal with their mindset to answer their question.
That's how I put upon it, and it's always hard to put ourselves in the mind, but I think, to your point, it's not so much about thinking about, if I'm going to restate, I think what you said, it's about making sure we bound our interpretations and bound our understanding to theirs, right? And it should reflect. That's how I view it too, right? He is talking to his apostles who are expecting him to be announcing that he's king any day, right? Like, that's what they were expecting up until the time he ascends up into heaven. That's what they're wanting. When will you announce yourself as king? And so it's bounded in that context. Again, always, when will you restore the throne to the nation of Israel?
As the whole nation was expecting.
That's true, yes. The nation was expecting it as well. I'm sorry, am I messing with you? All right.
Going back to Jerusalem, we'll talk about Matthew, but with the destruction of Jerusalem, you had like eight different times there. A lot of times you were focusing on the temple, but then you mentioned a lot about the wall, about being totally destroyed. Christ said, not one stone. Was he looking at the temple or was he looking at the area of Jerusalem? My question is, how would they know where any foundations or anything that related back to Solomon's temple could be found if each stone was removed and clean, right? I think he quoted Josephus that said, you know, he was destroyed early, almost to the point where you couldn't, you wouldn't even know there was a city. A city, not just a temple. How much is there today that could possibly be?
I think when Jesus says there's not one stone left on another, I have read this as it's always difficult, and I always have to qualify, because I believe in the Bible as being literally true, of course. But I think he's using hyperbolic or illustrative language, because the foundation is still there, right? If you go to the Western Wall, that foundation stones are the ones that Herod laid when building the Second Temple. You can go up underneath the tunnel. If anybody's taken that tour, go see the giant, even further down stones, right? So what he's talking about is just total and utter destruction, making it useless as a place, as an environment for worship, which it was. Now, you are correct. The entire city is going to suffer along with the temple, right? He's not just it. I think the focus is when they say, look at the temple, he's talking and answering about the temple being destroyed. But in his answer, when he says, encompassed by armies and blood, if he was saying simply, oh, the temple's going to be pulled down, you know, somebody's going to come in peaceably and say, guess what, we're taking your temple down. No, his answer is very much about violence and destruction overall, calamity coming to the entire, but is that right? Like I threw us right, like the verse, I'm going to misquote it, right? Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I would have gathered you under my wings. I think he's thinking holistically, but the answer is focused primarily on the temple.
I'll offer you just one more since you're trying to fill 4 minutes.
No. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to fill anything. Well,
just in support of what you said, you know, the great sound of the trumpet, most of us in the room probably would associate that with, you know, the resurrection. Like, you know, another great sound of the trumpet is Isaiah 27:13. The great sound of the trumpet that Isaiah gives there to gather all who have been scattered of Israel to the four winds of the land. It's the Jubilee trumpet, maybe. So just kind of in support of your point. Isaiah 27:13.
Isaiah 27:13 for those who didn't hear. Brother James.
In your reading about the ceiling of the golden gate, you showed in the picture that it was sealed, and you mentioned that it was in most historians think it was Suleiman the Magnificent that was gave the order to seal it. Did you read anything about the motivation for sealing the gate? Why would they close that gate?
So it depends on who you read. Arabic and Muslim historians of time say he just wanted to close it off and build a building next to it and have a closed wall. However, there is a tradition based on the verses talking about the sun coming to the east, the way the temple faces would face it, Mount Olive, why all of the right in front of here, what you can't tell that, but that's a graveyard. Those are all tombs. On the other side of the valley, if you were to look across the Kedron Valley, are all tombs. Both in Muslim and actually in Jewish tradition, the Messiah comes from the east and enters into the temple complex from the east. And particularly in Judaism, resurrection starts at the Mount of Olives. So that's why everybody wants to be buried at the Mount of Olives, and why it's a very reverent place is because that's where people want to be early on. So there is a tradition that says he blocked it up in order to probably not actually prevent the arrival of the Christian Messiah, but to show that he was contrary to it and wanted it not to happen, or showing his disdain for that approach. Is that the one you've heard too?
That's the explanation that some people hear. That's that it was a deliberate Islamic path to really in the face
very contrary to that. Did I get through this? Oh, my goodness. Okay, good. All right. We will pick up with history. Since we left with a German riding a horse in, if you know your history, we're going to know where we're going to pick up next time. With somebody else entering Jerusalem.